before the U.S. Invasion of Iraq, a lot of us watched George Bush on television. And, you know, the way we had to sum it up for any of our friends who asked us what he said was, well, basically he came on TV and lied for 30 minutes and got massive rounds of applause. But it's the... It's the particular lies that he's been telling, and I guess you'd have to agree with what I've said so far, right? About the out and out lying, or at the very least, gross distortions of reality in terms of the rationale for the invasion of Iraq.
Well, our book includes a copy of the October 7th speech that Bush gave, which is, I think, the most important single speech that anybody in the Bush administration gave before the war in terms of gathering the momentum in the United States political system to go to war. And we took apart that October 7th speech known as the Cincinnati speech sentence by sentence. And so in the appendix to the book, we basically have a lot of different independent scholars and researchers analyze what Bush said. And he distorted, he omitted, he lied, he prevaricated. He did all kinds of maneuvers, and of course his speech was written for him as well by many other people with his own involvement. So that's a long-winded way of saying, yeah, he told a lot of lies, and he thought it would work, and it did.
Perhaps the most the shameful part of the whole experience is the way the media has run with some of the misperceptions or misinformation that came out of some of those speeches that George Bush gave.
Yeah, this has been a challenge for Reese Ehrlich and I. Reese is the co-author of our book Target Iraq and has a long background as a foreign correspondent working independently. And by the way, he has reported for the BBC and the CBC and National Public Radio in the United States, but as an independent journalist. And when we analyzed what we wanted to do with this book, we came up with the subtitle, well, the title, I should say, is Target Iraq. The subtitle is What the News Media Didn't Tell You. And that was addressed primarily to those who were affected by U.S. media coverage. And we realized that by kind of staking out that marker, we would alienate, at least in the U.S., quite a few journalists and editors who like to believe that they told the public in the United States what it needed to know. In fact, there were so many omissions and distortions, not only coming from officials in Washington, but coming from U.S. news media, that frankly we could have made our book 1,000 pages long and not been redundant in terms of some of the major deceptions and omissions that needed to be corrected in the U.S. media. I think that in retrospect already, we can see the magnitude of the deception. For instance, here we are, we're speaking in mid-April, and where are the weapons of mass destruction? I mean, Colin Powell went to the United Nations Security Council a couple of months ago and swore up and down that there were all these chemical weapons that were going to be put on warheads and used around Baghdad, and those weapons are nowhere to be found.
Well, there was never any real evidence, was there, that Iraq had chemical weapons? I mean, if the previous and present weapons inspectors' perceptions of it matter at all.
No, there wasn't real evidence, and one of the sad things is that, in general, for the politicians in Washington and the prevailing national media outlets in the United States, evidence was beside the point. Colin Powell went to the UN and had some charts and graphs and ostensible photos or whatever, and on the strength of his reputation, many journalists were persuaded. And, you know, we devote a lot of pages in the book to Colin Powell because this is really an example in which the most obvious truths of the news media are falsehoods. The obvious truth was that Colin Powell didn't want to go to war. And that was the received wisdom last summer, last fall, into the winter. And I think we make a pretty persuasive case that Colin Powell was more responsible for getting the United States into a war on Iraq than anybody else in the U.S. government. It was kind of a good cop, bad cop routine. And part of the way in which Colin Powell was so persuasive on the strength of his vaunted reputation was that the U.S. media are very uninterested in history. I mean, here's a guy who has lied, who has connived throughout his public career going back a couple of decades. And we talk in the book about, for instance, his involvement in what became known as the Iran-Contra scandal, that he helped to oversee the transfer of several thousand TOW missiles to the CIA, and almost half of them then illicitly went to the Iranian government as part of that whole Iran-Contra scam. And when that was in danger of being revealed to Congress as an assistant to then-Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger, Colin Powell did what he could to hide it from Congress. He was quite deceptive intentionally. And then moving along in his career, when there was a chance that peace would break out in Central America, and he was working for the Reagan administration, he went to Central America to threaten governments such as El Salvador and Guatemala that they must not go with the Oscar Arias peace plan. And people remember that Mr. Arias was the president of Costa Rica. He later, as I recall, won a Nobel Peace Prize. He had a plan to end the bloodshed in Guatemala and El Salvador and Nicaragua. And as a strong-arm person in the Reagan administration, Colin Powell went to Latin America and said to those Central American regimes, look, if you don't knuckle under to us, if you bat an eye towards or provide any support for the Arias peace plan, we're going to cut you off at the knees. So Colin Powell got his way. The slaughter continued in Central America, and yet we're supposed to believe that this guy is a man of peace. One more quick Latin American example. When Panama was invaded in December of 1989, the British Guardian reporter, he was with the Guardian at the time, Martin Walker, explained that of all the people in the U.S. government, Colin Powell was the most responsible for the invasion of Panama. He was at that point the newly installed head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And when the invasion took place, Colin Powell declared publicly that it was necessary for the United States to nail to the wall, so to speak, figuratively speaking, a sign that says, and I quote, superpower lives here. So that's kind of the geopolitical outlook that Colin Powell has.
Well, and it makes sense in a way, because Panama would be an early example of where the United States went into a foreign country seeking a regime change.
Yes, absolutely. And the notion, what's sometimes called the Powell doctrine of overwhelming force that must be used. After the first Gulf War in 1991, Powell was asked how many Iraqi people had died as a result of the U.S. attack, and he said, that's not a number that interests me very much. Indeed, it's just not the kind of stats that he's at all interested in.
Well, none of them seem very interested in numbers when it comes to the casualties of the other side. I'm thinking of even Madeleine Albright's response when she was asked about the people who had perished because of the U.S. Economic sanctions on Iraq. I can't recall what her answer was exactly, but I think that's in your book too, isn't it?
Yes, we quote the interview with Madeleine Albright, who at the time of the interview was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. This was May of 1996. Of course, she was soon after that to become the U.S. Secretary of State. And on the CBS program 60 Minutes, she was asked by the reporter Leslie Stahl about the data showing that about 500,000 children had died because of the U.S.-led sanctions halfway through that decade. And Madeleine Albright responded that this was troubling, but, and I'm quoting here, we think the price is worth it. And this is kind of emblematic of the ways that I'm afraid U.S. foreign policy tends to be calibrated. The price that is worth it is the price paid by other people with lives, with environmental devastation, with wrecking of their cultural artifacts. And those who reap the benefits aren't even just people who live in the United States, but those smart guys, the foreign policy elites that have decided it's time to go to war or exert some kind of inordinate pressure from the United States. So it might sound to some listeners that I'm, so to speak, anti-American, as the saying goes, opposed to or hostile to the United States. I would want to disabuse people of that notion, in that I've been born in the United States and lived in the United States in this only life that I have. I love this country in many ways, but I'm very hostile to the U.S. foreign policy that's willing to take huge numbers of lives so that the corporate system can become more profitable and the Pentagon and State Department can exert more geopolitical power over various regions of the planet. And I have to say that now, in the wake of the second Gulf War, we've got this horrendous situation, which reminds me of a statement made by the great U.S. Peace activist A.J. Mustey, who said, after a war, the real problem is with the victors. He believes that he has just proven that violence is the solution. And then the question is, who is going to disabuse him of that notion? And it's very interesting, you know, we hear a lot about rogue states, but we have one superpower in the planet, on the planet, and I think we can say that that is a rogue superpower.
I was surprised to find out recently about the roots of some of the current, and I guess to some extent past, U.S. foreign policy in the Partnership for a New American Century.
Yeah. You have these guys who now are in power, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz, who were very unhappy in the 1990s because they didn't feel that the U.S. military power was being used sufficiently. They wanted a bigger iron fist to be swung and to be used not just in practice, but in actual warfare. So they put together this project on the New American Century, and I think we perhaps should pause and look at that name because, of course, I think it was Henry Luce, the Time Life publisher, who coined the phrase the American Century to apply to the 20th. And I find that a rather odious notion that the planet should have a century belonging to one country. But be that as it may, we're now obviously in another century. And the notion that in the late 1990s, this, I would call them a cabal, but you know, call them gentlemen, would get together and put out these long documents and planning scenarios and think tank papers, all predicated on the assumption that the 21st century was to be a new American, which is to say U.S. century. I think that says a lot about what their mindset is about, which is what some call hegemony, and all, I think, in looking at the facts, might have reason to believe is a an excessive domination of the planet by one country. So after being out of power, so to speak, now they're in power. And I believe that the attack on Iraq here in the spring of 2003 is a major step towards the direction they want to be moving in, which is more war, attacks on more countries, regime changes, and basically rearranging various regions, particularly the Middle East, to the liking of those who hold sway in Washington.
I wanted to take a little time to dispel some of the myths that are popular in the media for explaining the rationale of an invasion on Iraq. And although I hardly know where to begin, I think an excellent place to start is with weapons of mass destruction, which we did talk about briefly already.
Yeah.
But I think that bears some closer examination.
Well, it does, and there was a mythology created about the history, you know, the great saying from George Orwell's book, 1984, those who control the past control the future, those who control the present control the past. And one of the popular notions, which was promulgated both by politicians and media people in the United States in the run-up to this war, was that Saddam Hussein, in December of 1998, had kicked out UN weapons inspectors, the UNSCOM team, which comes under the category of interesting if true, but false. And you wouldn't know it from looking at the coverage, but it's an absolute falsehood. And all you'd have to do is go back to the very same U.S. media outlets that had promulgated this lie and go back 4 years, and you find in late 1998, it's very clear what happened. The UNSCOM UN inspection team, headed by Richard Butler, withdrew from Iraq under pressure from the United States right before what became known as the Desert Fox bombing, informally known as the Monica Lewinsky bombing, because that was in the midst of some impeachment unpleasantness that President Clinton was undergoing. That was a situation where the inspectors were withdrawn from Iraq by the UN under U.S. pressure, not kicked out by Saddam Hussein. And after the UNSCOM team withdrew itself from Iraq, of course, there was a period of well over 3 years before UN weapons inspectors returned. That kind of deception is the lie of commission, but there is the lie of omission. And that also, I think, is very relevant, because in early January of 1999, the news came out, and it was on the front page of the New York Times and other outlets, that Washington had been using the UN UNSCOM inspection team to spy on Iraq and to do it quite seriously, to identify targets, both military and in the leadership of the Saddam Hussein regime, for the U.S. to then know where to launch and target its missiles. This was incontrovertible. The stories in the New York Times and elsewhere cited as sources, senior U.S. government officials, never really denied. And yet, when that information would be extremely relevant in the year 2002, it was nowhere to be found in the U.S. media. It was information that simply dropped down the Orwellian memory hole. If you knew that information and had it for context, you would understand that the U.S. government, as the former UNSCOM inspector Scott Ritter has pointed out, the U.S. government basically wrecked the UNSCOM UN inspection process in the 1990s by subverting it, perverting it, using the inspection teams for espionage way beyond and in contravention to the mandate that those teams had from the United Nations. So when there was talk in 2002 of should inspectors be brought back or allowed back into Iraq, it seemed irrational, perhaps, or perfidious, the Iraqi hesitancy to allow those inspectors back in. But with background, you would understand that the espionage had been so much a subversion of the UN ostensible purpose of weapons inspection that the Iraqis would have reason to be reticent to allow basically teams that before, in another incarnation, had spied for Washington to have the run of their country. I mean, it's kind of elementary, but that's another example of ways in which the omission, in this case, of basic facts in U.S. news media really rewrite history.
And there remains, as we mentioned earlier, no evidence that Iraq has any weapons of mass destruction at all.
No, there's no evidence, and you know, being a superpower means that you can lie and then never have to say you're sorry.
One of the most troublesome things to me is the connection between Iraq or Saddam Hussein and 9/11.
Yeah.
Now, this is something that I find truly amazing because it's a complete myth, and I believe I read somewhere that something like 53% of Americans believe that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11.
Yeah, we talked about that in the book,
and
even the White House, even the Bush administration has never claimed that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with 9/11. They've tried to tie Saddam Hussein's regime to al-Qaeda after the fact, but not that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with what happened on September 11, 2001. And yet, as you say, polls have shown upwards of half the U.S. public believing that tie to exist. And I think part of that is because the administration has dropped so many hints and innuendos, and a lot of right-wing pundits in the U.S. media have done the same, and it's just kind of, if you throw enough mud, people kind of associate the target with the mud, and it tends to work. I think in a broader sense, in a chapter called Spinning 9/11, we discuss in the book how essentially the Bush administration was able to take the occurrence of 9/11 as a license to kill. And as the aggrieved party, the U.S. government was then ready, willing, and able to portray itself as essentially the world's biggest victim. You know, no other country has ever suffered a disaster. No other country has ever been bombed or lost its citizens. That's kind of the pretense. In any way, nearly as egregious as that occurrence on 9/11 in the United States, and therefore, the very strong implication is no more Mr. Nice Guy. We're going to strike first, ask questions later. It's much better, when in doubt, to attack. And so we're going to root out these problems before they become too large to prevent an attack on the United States. There was a very interesting byplay between the White House spokesperson, Ari Fleischer, and one of the few decent reporters at the White House, the Hearst newspaper columnist, Helen Thomas, right before this Gulf War began, just a number of weeks ago this year, when Helen Thomas pressed Ari Fleischer in this way. She said, look, you and the president and other administration officials keep claiming that the Iraqi regime is a threat to people in the United States. Please explain to me how the Iraqi government is a threat. And after hemming and hawing, Ari Fleischer finally said, well, it's very clear. The Iraqi regime is a threat to the United States because it's a threat to U.S. troops that have been deployed in the Persian Gulf region. And I think that kind of explains the circular logic here. There's also a parallel where the U.S. government and its acolytes in the media, beginning last summer, were propounding this notion of a so-called preemptive strike. And the premise there was that if you believe or can claim to believe, more to the point, that your country may be attacked at some point in the future by country A, then your government, your country, has a right to attack country A first. And immediately the logic of that breaks down, because if that were the case, then last fall the Iraqi government would have had every justification to launch an attack on the United States, since nobody was making a secret of the U.S. plans. But if we go with that sort of a precept, then the world just goes into chaos. You may as well throw the United Nations away as any kind of meaningful world body, which, frankly, in terms of preventing wars, I'm not sure we're too far from right now, thanks to the United States.
Right.
And I'm afraid that all of this really boils down to one central axiom that now is pivotal for the U.S. government foreign policy, and that can be summed up in three words: might makes right.
It certainly looks that way.
It absolutely does, and I think for people in Canada, I mean, you're living with this rather gargantuan military state directly to your south, and I don't know exactly what it's like looking at it from north of the U.S.-Canada border, but I know from south of that border, I find it very upsetting to be a U.S. citizen and living here and seeing this rampant militarism just railing and rolling down the deadly track of U.S. foreign policy.
I think the rift in U.S.-Canada relations that I don't know if the U.S. media reports on, but certainly the Canadian media does, I think it's a little blown out of proportion. To me, it seems pretty much business as usual. I mean, I don't think the U.S. and U.S.-Canada relations have certainly been more than strained at very frequently in the past, and I don't think that what's going on now, it seems all that odd. I don't know.
And it seems to me that you've got examples of Tony Blair, who has been accused of or likened to being George Bush's poodle. I think that's a bit unfair. I think he's more like a border collie. And then you have, in contrast, of course, the heads of the governments of Germany and France. And then you have, I think, somewhere in the middle, the Canadian government, which, as I understand it, did not support the U.S. attack on Iraq this spring. But they didn't exactly raise holy hell about it either. And
It's a matter of perception, because up here, what we get pointed out to us in the media quite often are members of parliament making rather strong anti-American remarks, and other civil servants. As far as the war goes, yes, Jean Chrétien is against the war, and he also has made some very strong statements about the legality of regime change.
Well, I think that's to the good. I think it should be encouraged. Let me put it this way. The U.S. government is tone deaf when it comes to other countries. It becomes suddenly hard of hearing when there's anything that they don't want to hear. And so the louder and more explicit these denunciations can be, the more chance there is to make some kind of impact.
I'll tell you something, though. The Canadian media has been virtually at war with public opinion in Canada. Polls seem to indicate the majority of Canadians are opposed to the war in Iraq. And the media seems to be constantly doing an American media-style hard sell. It's really strange to watch. And sadly, if recent polls can be believed, it seems to be working. It seems more and more Canadians don't seem to mind it, I guess, despite the fact that it, you know, violates all kinds of international conventions, agreements, laws, the UN Charter.
Well, there is some triumphalism that tends to become contagious. I mean, it becomes clear on examination that perhaps 2,000 or more Iraqi civilians have been killed in recent weeks by U.S.-U.K. bombs, upwards of 10 or 20,000 other Iraqis killed, often in retreat mode. And as well, you have to look at, I think, the environmental degradation, the destruction of infrastructure, which is taking lives as we speak, sanitation, health care. The U.S. troops in Baghdad in the last week, they protected the oil ministry office. They protected the interior ministry office, where the intelligence and secret police data are. But they didn't protect the museums. They didn't protect the libraries. 7,000 years of the cradle of civilization history up in smoke, smashed, looted, and the people who run the U.S. government couldn't be bothered to protect it.
They also couldn't be bothered to protect hospitals, I noticed. I'm no lawyer, but I understand that that's also a violation of some international law or other.
It is a violation of Geneva Conventions, and the Hague Conventions have been violated in terms of not protection of national treasures and artifacts. Having visited a children's hospital, the Al-Mansour Pediatric Teaching Facility in Baghdad last September and last December, I'm infuriated that the U.S. troops didn't bother to immediately protect the hospitals. They just let those facilities be looted. And I think it says a lot about priorities, because what does it mean that the troops were immediately deployed to protect the oil ministry office? There are hospitals, they're on the maps, everybody knew where they were. The hell with them is the attitude. And then now you have Rumsfeld just kind of mumbling about how, you know, it's untidy sometimes to establish democracy.
This is another myth that I find troublesome, the whole notion that there will be a democracy imposed on Iraq. That's not likely to happen for several reasons, is it?
Well, I think you're right, it's not happening. I mean, already certain elites have been pulled together to have meetings. You have this former General Gardner, who's taking control as a so-called civilian administrator for, we're told, perhaps 6 months. But beyond that, Ahmed Chalabi is being shoehorned in, perhaps to be the designated Iraqi leader, designated by the United States. And I think you're alluding to this as well, Ron. The Shiites make up about 60% of the Islamic population in Iraq, and which is to say that they are the most populous group, and if there were democratic elections, the Shiites would dominate a government. There's no way the U.S. wants that. There are 112 billion barrels of oil to be underneath the ground, yet to be siphoned out of it, according to the best estimates. The U.S. does not want, despite rhetoric to the contrary,
right,
the U.S. does not want that oil to be in the hands of a government that's, shall we say, non-cooperative with U.S.-based oil conglomerates. So, you know, you figure the odds. I mean, I think my odds of going to Las Vegas and making $1 million in the next week with the $100 I have in my bank account are significantly greater than the odds that the U.S. is going to pursue policies to promote democracy in Iraq.
There's another thing that I wanted to mention before we totally moved away from the rationale justifying the invasion, and that is this gassing of the Kurds in the 80s that keeps getting dredged up over and over and over again. And aside from the obvious question, you know, what did you do about it at the time, this has been a really effective tool for them. hasn't it, in getting public support on side?
Yeah. Well, the U.S., as you're alluding to, I think, didn't do much about it at the time except to facilitate it. And you go back to the history of it, and during the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, the United States tilted towards Iraq, provided intelligence data to the Iraqi military, provided precursor chemicals, as did some other countries. And so when then we get in this question of, does that history matter? And defenders of the U.S. policy say, well, you know, that's a long time ago. It doesn't matter. Why bring it up? And yet constantly in the U.S. media, we have heard how the Saddam Hussein regime gassed its own people. So there it's very selective, where depending on the moment and the point being made, we've been told by the U.S. government that either history matters profoundly or it doesn't matter at all.
Well, one interesting aspect of the story is the way at the time, well, I guess there's two things. One is there was a bill apparently before the government in the United States that proposed economic sanctions for this event at the time, which was, I guess, Reagan and his administration at the time had some role in vetoing in some way.
Well, Reagan was very happy, and the administration was really happy with aligning with Iraq. As a matter of fact, there was really no clash of any fundamental nature whatsoever between the U.S. government and Iraq until early August of 1990, when Iraq invaded Kuwait. And then they were buddies who had crossed their buddies. And then that couldn't be permitted to stand, as the first President Bush put it.
Something else we should talk about in relation to the war on Iraq and the media is the lack of voices of dissent in the mainstream media. I live in a city that, like many cities in North America, there are weekly marches, rallies, protests that are extremely large. And my understanding is that this is not only happening all over America, it's happening all over the world on a pretty much daily basis, even inside Iraq now. Why don't we hear these voices in the mainstream media?
Well, I can tell you about my personal experiences, just for what they're worth. The book that I co-authored, Target Iraq, was published in late January. And at that point, I had visited Iraq three times. In September, I went with a current member of Congress, Nick Rahal, and a former U.S. senator named James Abarask, and as well as the head of a humanitarian group called Conscience International. And then in December, I went with the actor and director, Sean Penn. And then in late January, I went with the former head of the U.N. Oil for Food Program, Dennis Halliday. And so in January and February and early March, while I was very, and continue to be very anti-war, I received a fair number of invitations to go on CNN and, to a lesser extent, Fox and MSNBC. And I did that, I would say, about a dozen times in the winter and very early spring of this year. But after the war started, I received absolutely zero invitations from CNN, zero invitations from MSNBC, and yesterday I received an invitation from Fox News. I don't know if that will pan out. But it's just to say that I was getting called very often, or fairly often, until the war started, and then once it started, the assumption of the major networks in the United States, for television anyway, was that there was no reason to debate anything anymore. That once the war started, it was pretty much a non-issue as to whether the war should happen, and the only question was how it should be waged and imposed by the U.S. military. And I think that's generally been the case as well in coverage of anti-war activity in the United States. There was, you know, intermittent coverage, some of it substantial, but once there was a consensus in the government that it was time to go to war, anti-war sentiment was pretty much ignored by the U.S. media.
And now is at a time when people were literally getting arrested almost in the thousands across the United States. It seems ridiculous to me that the media could ignore something like that.
In the first day of the war, there were more than 1,000 people arrested for civil disobedience in the streets of San Francisco. Right. And I saw just a little crawl, a few words, along the bottom of the screen of CNN. I mean, there just was not much focus on it at that point. You know, we're just being portrayed at that stage as kind of, you know, peripheral to the major drama, which is that the people in Washington had decided to go to war.
Something that really bothers me is that the average, you know, fairly well-informed high school student can poke holes in American foreign policy.
Yeah.
And the media obviously plays a really important role in explaining, well, the government's, you know, rationale, if not, you know, if not reasoning.
Well, I have to say, you know, and this is not some kind of false modesty, and I won't brag about being modest here either. It's just to say that I don't really think that what I've written in this book in terms of media criticism is a result of being particularly smart. I mean, it's just logic. It's just comparing and contrasting, like we're supposed to do with basic logic, what the claims are, what the U.S. government officials have said, what major news media outlets have told their readers and listeners and viewers, and then seeing whether there's a logical consistency and comparing it to the factual information that's really known. And as you say, there are huge holes in the purported arguments for war, and the kind of the bad news is that it's seen in the U.S. media as extraordinary to do that, to actually compare information, because we're supposed to have like a memory with a half-life of about 10 minutes.
Well, and it seems that that there may be some truth to that, I guess. I don't know. I'm not sure about public opinion in the U.S., but I'm guessing that most people there would support the war.
Oh, yeah, that's what the polls indicate. Anyway, yeah. Although, you know, if a question was asked a certain way before the war began, would you rather the U.S. attack Iraq, or would you rather the U.S. not attack Iraq while U.N. inspections continue? It was clear that more people wanted the inspections to continue rather than a war begin. So it was all in the way that the questions were framed, and of course, Bush was able to simply sweep the pieces off the board by saying, look, I'm going to attack, what do you think of that?
Well, that's the trouble with polls.
Yeah, it's the trouble with polls, and it's the trouble with the kind of militaristic mentality that's holding sway in this case in the government of a country that has huge firepower and is willing to use it.
Right. Well, my question was going to be, the original, what I was getting to was not actually to demean you in any way, but what I was trying to say earlier was that, you know, provided that reasonably well-informed people of all ages can poke such gaping holes in the foreign policy, how is it that they keep getting away with it? Because we're looking at a situation with Syria now, right now, where we're hearing the same myths over again. I mean, personally, I don't know as much about Syria as I do about Iraq, but I'm guessing a lot of what I hear coming from the media right now is going to turn out to possibly not be true as well. For example, weapons of mass destruction in Syria, and they seem to be making a strong connection with some organizations that are considered terroristic, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, considered by who is always the question.
Well, this is what I was going to say. Canada, like the United States, has a official government list of terrorist organizations, but I think that some of the groups that are alleged to be operating in Syria would probably be on both of those lists.
Yeah, and in Lebanon, the Hezbollah and so forth, mm-hmm. definitely backed by Syria. I mean, I think that Syria backs terrorism. I think the United States backs terrorism. I mean, I think that this is the problem where what's good for the goose is not good for the gander. The United States is supporting the Turkish government that's terrorized Kurds. The United States is funneling billions of dollars a year to Israel, which, in my opinion, terrorizes Palestinians with rockets and attack helicopters and strafing children. I mean, it's just a matter, I believe, of a challenge for us to be even-handed about this. And the righteousness that we hear from the U.S. government, it's really hard to take when one looks at what that government is doing itself.
I can't believe they're getting away with it.
Yeah, well,
I totally do not understand how it is that, you know, we can turn on a TV, we can watch George Bush say his piece, we can know he's lying, and that he gets away with it. This is...
Yeah, well, that was the nub of your question, which I really didn't address directly, and I think the reason I didn't is that it's hard to fathom and hard to explain. I mean, I've been writing about media and propaganda for upwards of 20 years now, and I still can't totally explain it because it goes to the essence of what it means to live in a very democratic and thoroughly propagandized society, which is where I live, certainly, in the United States. And I would just say that the essence of propaganda is repetition. And when people get implicit and explicit messages on such a constant basis that are skewed and carefully selected just by virtue of what is normalized, then people have a tendency to go along, to get along with the most dominant, I won't say thought, but what passes for the most dominant sorts of ideas and thoughts.
Excuse me if I'm misunderstanding you, but do you consider to be the United States to be a fairly open democracy?
I think it's a democracy in the sense that we have a First Amendment. There is largely freedom of speech, and I think that's important. I think that there are elections where people make decisions, but I also think that the United States is a democracy that has many oligarchic elements, and so it's a truncated democracy where much of what goes on is actually quite manipulated by the wealthy and powerful. So I guess I say democracy with quotation marks around the words, not to claim that there is no democracy, but I think that it is severely curtailed and limited, and on the key issues, quite often it's almost as though we live in a dictatorship.
What do you think is the solution to the way the media has been, I guess in Canada, I should let you know, as well as in the United States, has been treating the war on Iraq and I guess the continuing occupation? Is there a way of fighting back other than, I guess the best thing to do is keep yourself informed?
Well, there are ways to fight back. None of them are any silver bullets, but for instance, I work with the Media Watch Group FAIR, which can be found on the web at www.fair.org. That's just FAIR.org. And they do content analysis. They have a media activist list of about 40,000 that gets email bulletins. And they basically do research and then organize and work to challenge and confront major media outlets. And I think that's important, whether in Canada or the United States or anywhere else, that we take a very assertive stance and, if you will, aggressive stance, nonviolently speaking, towards the major media outlets. Research what they're doing. If it's a Globe and Mail, if it's a Star, whatever the newspaper happens to be, for instance, if they're not being even-handed, if they're inaccurate, if they're deceptive, if they're skewed, if they're serving as pro-corporate flacks, we need to do the research and then confront them, whether it means demonstrations or leafleting or whatever that may entail. And I think also we need to build and sustain independent media outlets, whether it's, you know, this radio program or independent newspapers, magazines, websites, films, video projects, agitprop theater, you know, whatever you name. That's when we begin to utilize democratic possibilities. So I'm very much in favor of confronting corporate government media and also building alternatives.
I guess as a kind of a final question, Noam Chomsky has been warning of the potential for the United States to invade both Syria and Iran for quite a while now. And I was just wondering what you think the future holds for Syria.
I see it as an ominous possibility, and when we think about how asserted the agenda-setting process was for Iraq prior to the invasion, it seems that such an attack on Syria could be many months or maybe even years away, but I do think it's more than a gleam in the eye of some policymakers. It was very interesting, in the middle of April here, Colin Powell made a statement because there was quite a to-do after some comments came from Washington officials about, you know, Syria has to watch its step, words to that effect. Colin Powell made a statement that was widely reported in the U.S. media that Colin Powell said the United States has no plans to attack Syria. But I heard the actual statement, his voice, on the radio. And what Colin Powell actually said was that the United States now has no plans to attack Syria. And I would take the guy at his words. But it seems clear to me that there are already contingency plans well underway to attack Syria. It would not at all surprise me if first there were some missile attacks on certain camps inside Syria with the claims that there were weapons of mass destruction or the claims that there were Al-Qaeda people there or claims that other terrorist groups had bases or that some of the Saddam Hussein regime officials were in exile in Syria. You know, any excuse one could imagine, but I think such an attack could take place. And whether it's Syria or Iran or some other country, I think the United States has officials at the top of the government who feel they're on a roll, and they just may want to keep on rolling.
Which it would be extremely dangerous. I read today, I think, that Iran, somebody in the Iranian government released a statement saying that they would consider an attack on Syria to be an attack on Iran.
I think you're right. It would be extremely dangerous, and it's a reality that underscores the importance, whether we live in North America or anywhere else, we have to work to restrain governments that are going to try to use military power as a substitute for some kind of rational international diplomacy.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us, and also thanks for the book. It's excellent.
Oh, I'm glad you found it useful, Ron, and thanks for the discussion. I enjoyed it.